This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, 1.3 million whose unemployment benefits just ran out. The unemployment insurance program provides laid-off workers with a fraction, just a fraction, of their old salary for a fixed period of time while they search for a new job. And now roughly 1.3 million out-of-work Americans lost their unemployment insurance because Congress declined to renew an emergency aid program for the jobless that expired. Well, whilst Democrats have said they'll come back in early January and try to renew the emergency unemployment compensation program, if that effort fails, the nation's safety net for the unemployed has already been shrunken drastically.
Congress has also slated to debate how much more to cut the Supplemental Assistance Nutrition Program or food stamps. But what's not on the agenda for Congress is devising a way out of the recession for the 99%, which has been prolonged by continued federal deficit reduction and income inequality. Richard Esgrow looks at what is to be done about job creation, wage stagnation, and income and wealth inequality, now talks to us about the escalating tragedy of continuing unemployment in the U.S., and he's a fellow of the Campaign for America's Future.
Well, let's start with the most ominous and perhaps obvious, but it needs to be said in any event. What is it that these 1.3 million people whose unemployment benefits just expired, what do they face? What's ahead? And what is the expectation from Congress upon their return?
Well, first of all, as you noted a minute ago, it's devastating. It's devastating economically, and anyone who knows anything about the unemployment process knows it's also devastating psychologically. And this cut is being made at a time when there is absolutely no glimmer of hope for the long-term unemployed. You know, the newspapers cover variations in the overall unemployment rate, but the fact is for the long-term unemployed, who are the people directly affected by this, there has been no lessening of the situation for them, no brightening of their prospects. For every job available, there are roughly three job seekers. So there's no way, you know, the Republican argument for this, the conservative argument, is that somehow the unemployment benefit causes the unemployment, which is madness. And the proof of that is that once these benefits stop, that number didn't change. There are still three people for every available job. So what it basically means is that unless Congress can be convinced to do something for them, it's really a horrifying prospect for quite a few of our fellow citizens, and we ought to be up in arms about that.
And it should be noted also that that's 1.3 million who were cut off when the program ended on the 28th. But, of course, there'll be more and more workers who are reaching the limit on the state's 26 weeks unemployment who will be thrown off much quicker in the future. So there's a lot more people involved even than that.
Obviously, there are mortgages that are in peril. There are car payments to deal with. There's the general kind of way that people, families live their life, which they can't do anymore. When I take this in conjunction with something as elementary as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is actually SNAP, they changed the name to disguise the reality. It's food stamps, which were cut drastically, and there's still further discussions about cuts and shredding the safety net. So what do we do, or how do we begin to look at the incredible disparity between really the poor and those people who are being pushed further down the ladder to economic impoverishment, and the fact that there are some people, indeed, who are getting a free lunch?
Well, I think they're getting more than a free lunch. I think they're getting a dinner, and it's all catered.
And dessert.
But not their just dessert.
Right, okay.
You know, look, I think that it's all of a piece. You know, I mean, we're hearing people say, for example, that we should be celebrating the recent budget deal that was negotiated, because there were no cuts to Social Security and Medicare, which of course is a good thing. In return, Republicans didn't have to increase taxes on the wealthy or corporations, including corporations who hide their profits offshore. But what that really means in human terms is that we're still coddling corporations whose real taxation rate is at almost a 60-year low. We're still seeing the wealthiest individuals paying tax rates that are half of what they paid under Ronald Reagan, even the beginning of the Reagan term. So we still have the situation of enormous disparity. We still have, as a result of that deal, half of, you know, these so-called sequester cuts have been devastating to the economy, as well as all the spending cuts that preceded that last round of cuts. And great, this deal did get rid of half of them for 1 year and then a quarter of them for the following year, but that still means a half step into more misery, more wage inequality, fewer jobs, and increased poverty at the same time that the response is to decrease benefits to people who have no jobs or who are already in poverty. So we have really a situation where we're hitting the American people coming and going. And that's what we're facing here. I mean, what we're facing is a pitched battle in a class war fought from the top down.
Well, I hate to say it, but it's even grimmer than you say, because as you well know, because you've written about it numerous times, the budget deal is based upon, predicated upon the fact that we need to reduce the budget, that we need to reduce the deficit. And that itself is creating a situation where the economy is faltering, cannot grow, and unemployed multiply.
Well, you are a tax and spend kind of liberal, aren't you, Ken?
I don't know. What do you think about that, Richard?
Well, I think that, first of all, taxing and spending is what made this country great. And I think we shouldn't be, you know, we've been allowed to be, and I'm not speaking to the two of you, but I think that liberalism, progressivism as a movement has become intimidated and afraid to say, yeah, there are times when spending makes sense. You know, I spent time in the business world, in the corporate world. We weren't afraid to spend when the time was right to spend and the rewards were sufficient to justify it. We called it investment. And I think one of the tragedies of the past 5 years is that it's been an ideal time for government investment. The borrowing costs for the federal government, they're beginning to go up now, but they have been so low that literally investors were paying the U.S. government to borrow money, and instead we were worried about reducing deficits at a time when we should have been investing in job creation and growing the economy. The economics of it, it's all worked out. We've seen this in Europe. If you cut, it's foolishness, even from a deficit reduction point of view. If you cut too quickly, well, that's what they discovered in Europe, is that your overall deficit goes up because your economy shrinks and the government is driven further into debt as it's starved of tax revenues and as the economy fails to grow. So even if you're only concerned about deficit reduction, we should have been investing, and we should still be investing in growing the economy. And by the way, that's not the only thing we should be concerned about. We should be concerned about the human reality that's affecting tens of millions of people in this country. And if we do that, believe me, we have many ways to manage our debt problem once the crisis, which has now gone on for 5 years, has ended for millions of Americans.
Richard, I wasn't being so much flippant before when we were talking about corporate America's free lunch. There really are issues very specific to that, juxtaposed with taking these painful cuts to food stamps from those who are most needy. I wonder if you can talk a bit about that. That is America's, or corporate America's, free lunch. What are we referring to?
Well, among other things, you know, there are deductions for meals, entertainments, jets. The oil industry gets $4 billion of tax breaks every year. Corporations are allowed to hide their tax revenues offshore and escape taxation. There are a number of proposals to address that, but they keep getting buried. So we have major corporations that haven't paid a penny in taxation for years. We have others that have had a year off, including banks like Wells Fargo, which have spent at least 1 year paying no taxes at all, while at the same time being given billions through the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and other government institutions, only to turn around and do things like violate drug money laundering laws or foreclosure fraud laws and go unprosecuted and continue to invest their corporate tax-free money and the time of their executives in organizations like Fix the Debt, which are designed to convince us that our real problem is deficit spending. It's a vicious cycle which draws in politicians and the campaign contribution process and benefits for the wealthy and the corporations, and people have to be conscious of that on a daily basis, and I think we all need to be working very hard to organize ourselves to resist it.
So you would say that the food stamps are among the best form, really, of economic stimulus?
Well, absolutely. Look, I think if we're talking, that's the other piece of it. While we're giving tax breaks to millionaires, the amount of money being spent by high-income individuals in this country is at historic lows. They literally don't know what to do with the money, so they just leave it there. It's not a stimulus program to give tax breaks to billionaires and corporations, but virtually every dollar that goes in unemployment insurance immediately gets spent, and that's a stimulus because these are people who are struggling to survive, as you said, on a fraction of their previous income. Every dollar that gets invested in the food stamp program immediately gets spent and finds its way to the grocery stores of America, to the shopkeepers of America, to the farmers of America, to the transport drivers of America. This is money that gets spent right away, and that's the money we're cutting while we're protecting the tax expenditures, as they call them, the tax breaks that are stifling the economy.
So what you're saying, if I get it right, is that economic inequality impedes economic growth.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, I think we've reached the point now where even some of the most influential and powerful financial executives in this country are beginning to realize it. Now, what they might do about it is different from what you or I might do about it, but it's gotten to the point where there's probably some folksy saying about a blind dog can find a truffle or something, but everybody, after a certain point, begins to realize, virtually everybody except the fanatical, begins to realize that inequality is killing the economy. You can go for only so long being pumped up by the Federal Reserve and inflating the stock market with bubbles of one kind or another. After a point, the party ends for everybody, and if you don't have a robust economy built on a healthy middle class, you're in for real trouble. And I think in private conversations with people on Wall Street or even in some of the public efforts we're seeing now, even people with vested financial interests are beginning to be concerned, and they're very right to be concerned.
So billionaires, we know, still pay lower tax rates than their own secretaries, and multinationals like General Electric still pay nothing in taxes, shipping jobs and reporting profits abroad to avoid paying their fair share. So what are we going to tell the Democrats to do? Should they, and it is the real issue here, which Ken Seams and you two have articulated, is this is the time to actually spend to turn to job creation and to advocate investment in order to deal with this sagging economy?
Well, absolutely. I think in terms of communicating to the Democrats, I think number one is words aren't enough. You know, we're going to hear a lot of rhetoric, for example, about increasing the minimum wage, which is vital to improving the economy as well, and that's great. But when they were doing their budget deal, they didn't force the minimum wage as an issue. So I think, you know, when we hear in advance of the 2014 election talk about the minimum wage, we're going to say we want to see a clear delineation between you and the Republicans on this. We want to see the Senate passing a minimum wage bill. We want to see Congress forcing it. In terms of food stamps or SNAP program, and in terms of unemployment insurance, we want you out there on the front lines every day. We want you to understand, you know, 2013 is ending with a big battle within the Democrats between the so-called centrists who represent corporate interests and are actually far to the right of the center of public opinion, and the ones they're calling economic populists, the Elizabeth Warrens and so on. We need to be telling them that those economic populists represent what we believe in, and if you're not going to fight for what they're fighting for, we'll take you out and we'll run somebody who will. I mean, I think that it's really time to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire on this for the nation's good and parenthetically also for the Democrats' good, because that's how they win elections.
For the new year, we have final message.
Final message for the new year, fight. That there are reasons to be optimistic for the grieving we do and the gnashing of teeth and so on. That there have been good signs this year, which we don't have time to go into, that people are politically are beginning to feel the pressure. So keep the pressure up, and I think we can get something done in 2014.
Richard Eskow, Senior Fellow of the Campaign for America's Future, and I also advise people to go to the website. There's all kinds of good stuff on that.
Ourfuture.org.
And it's, Richard said, what to do for the new year, fight. Well, go to the website. There's a lot of intellectual armaments to fight with and to begin to deal with the enormity of the wealth inequality and the incredible gap in wealth distribution, and we've got our work set out for the new year.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed the mark. When there was earth to plow, all guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done, brother. Can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done, brother. Can you spare a dime? It was Al all the time. Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare down? Buddy, can you spare? Done.
Buddy, Can You Spare a Dime, composed by Yip Harburg, was sung by Odetta and Dr. John. Now the testimony of unemployed workers imploring Congress to stop unemployment benefits from expiring, how the benefits help them keep their homes and even pay for gas to get to job interviews.
Good morning, Representative. My name is Lisa Floyd, and for nearly 14 years, I've worked as Director of Volunteer Services for an area nonprofit hospice which serves both West Virginia and Ohio. I have worked my entire adult life, having had three jobs my whole career, and I had never been unemployed until now. As soon as I lost my job, I immediately began my furious search for employment and began navigating the world of online job boards and diligently networking. My goal was to place my resume in the hands of everyone I knew. I have spent the majority of my waking hours looking for work. During this time, I was able to support myself because I received those vital unemployment insurance benefits. I not only was looking for jobs in my field or only for jobs at the same salary level. I'm smart enough to know that most likely I would be changing careers and taking a pay cut. I applied for everything and anything. Eventually, I began applying for entry-level call center jobs, jobs that would have resulted in a $30,000 a year pay cut, or to put this another way, a 42% reduction in my pay. That was Monday of this week. In a box on the floor by my desk, I have a stack of job application receipts, job descriptions, research, and various forms of my resume and cover letters. This stack is 2 feet tall, and I know because I measured it. In addition, my online network connections have literally gone viral. My regular state unemployment benefits ended in early November, and I immediately began receiving federal emergency unemployment compensation. I wouldn't have been able to pay my mortgage, and I would have been at risk of losing my beloved little house. I was raised by my mother, a single parent. We never owned a home, but we lived in apartments. So I'm especially proud of my home. And I know that my deceased mother would have been proud to know that she raised me right. I am somebody. I own a home. Now, in the 8th month of my job search, I'm happy to say that I have secured a job just 3 days ago. Thank you. Again, that was Monday. And although my new job pays much, much less than what I was making, it is a good job with a livable wage. And for that, I am very grateful. Without unemployment insurance and the federal emergency benefits, I would have not been able to sustain myself in my job search. So for me, these programs have done what they are supposed to do. They kept me in my home. I could still buy groceries and pay my bills. My anxiety, was kept to a manageable level, and I was able to keep sending out applications and going on interviews. If it had not been fortunate in finding this job, I would have faced the year-end cutoff of federal emergency unemployment compensation benefits, absent congressional action. For millions, that would be devastating. For me, it could have meant the loss of my beloved home. I am so relieved and grateful that I won't have to face that now, but I know millions of others are at the same risk that I was just 2 days ago. Again, Monday. I am here on their behalf, pleading with Congress to renew the Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program for 2014. And please give the other 1.3 million Americans a fighting chance to become reemployed. I am an emergency unemployment compensation success story. Won't you please allow this to be America's story? Thank you.
My name is Stan Ostowitz. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a journeyman wire electrician. I've been one since 1975. I've done electrical work ever since I was a teenager. I'm 67 years young, and I'm capable, fully able, and eager to work. I need to work. I love to work. It's who I am. I'll tell you this. I hate being unemployed. It's a waste of my time, my abilities. And during the recent recession and the early part of recovery, I was fortunate to have continuous work for a 3-year period on a job. Knowing work in my industry can be sporadic, I put away money from that job and I've saved. My 5-month job had ended earlier this year and I was on July 3rd. And now the unemployment insurance, which is my only income, and I've used my savings that I put away. I'm in the 20th week of my regular state unemployment benefits, and they'll end in January. Unemployment benefits have helped me scrape by week to week. And even with them, I'm not able to pay my portion of expenses for the apartment I share. Trying to find a job is a very difficult thing. Construction work is a hard find in the winter, and outside of my industry, from what I've seen, potential employers see my age and look right past me. I still get up at 4:30 every morning. That's Saturdays and Sundays. I'm actively pursuing work through my union and elsewhere. I hate not work. So here I am facing the end of my unemployment benefits in January, and this Congress does not act to renew the Federal Emergency Employment Compensation Program. There will be no federal benefits available for me and for people like me. If that happens, I'm still unemployed. I won't be able to even pay the basics. If Congress lets the UEC program shut down, I won't be able to put gas in my car to even look for a job. Tell me how that's going to help me and help others like me get back to work. Don't allow them to shut this down. Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.